Good morning. It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to focus our attention on Iran. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has been confirmed by Iran's supreme leader as its president over the protests of those who think the election was rigged. But that's not the only issue facing Iran. New confrontations with the West are looming. Iran's top reformists are about to be put on trial. Iran is holding 3 U.S. citizens prisoner, and there's a host of other issues. My guest is an expert on the region. He is Jamshid Choksi, professor of Central Eurasian Studies, History, Ancient Studies, and India Studies, and adjunct professor of Religious Studies at Indiana University. He's a specialist in Iranian history and religions who has traveled throughout Iran. Good morning, Professor Choksi, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, John.
A few weeks ago, it appeared that there were some pretty significant cracks in the support for the Iranian government, or at least within the power structure. Now, Mr. Ahmadinejad has been confirmed as Iran's president, and reformists are being put on trial. Does this mean that the differences within the Iranian hierarchy have been resolved, or what's the significance of this?
Far from being resolved, John. What has happened is we have the supreme leader confirming Ahmadinejad as the new president, and presumably Ahmadinejad will be sworn in as president tomorrow on schedule. However, your listeners probably have heard that at yesterday's endorsement, the key clerics who are opposing the current regime were not present. So Rafsanjani, Khatami, both of whom have also been former presidents of Iran, were not present, nor were any of the other 3 presidential candidates. So I think the splits all remain in play, and we should expect to see a slow but steady contestation of the regime.
What about this crackdown on those who have who protested the elections? Some reformists, including some rather highly placed clerics, are they now being put on trial? There have been threats issued against anyone who speaks out against the trial. The defendants aren't allowed to have lawyers. That kind of thing. What does this mean in terms of what the reform movement will be able to actually accomplish going forward?
What the reform movement will accomplish going forward is hard to say. What the regime seems to be doing is attempting to quash any dissent. But it's also interesting, John, that what they have done is the people on trial are not, shall we say, the top dissidents. They have not so far dared arrest Rafsanjani or Khatami. Among those arrested on trial are, for example, former vice presidents. So there's one individual who served as vice president under Khatami, who is on trial. So they seem to have gone, shall we say, for the second and third ranks of the opposition, rather than the top leaders so far. Maybe they're attempting to send a warning shot across the bow of the opposition. But it is unclear whether even if the trial continues, even if these individuals are sentenced to imprisonment, it's unclear whether that will quash the movement or not.
The other piece of this is the mourning period, the 40-day mourning period for Nida, the woman who was shot mm-hmm. during a protest and who has become something of a symbol. At her funeral, mourners shouted, "Nida is alive, Ahmadinejad is dead." How powerful a symbol is she, and will her martyrdom, if we can call it that, make a real difference?
She is a powerful symbol in that she is a very public face known to the world. And the protesters in Iran know that we know about that. So they are able to use that as a means of, shall we say, venting their rage against the regime. It's interesting, what the protesters are chanting is no longer debt to America, debt to Britain, or debt to Israel. What they are chanting now is debt to Khamenei, debt to Ahmadinejad, debt to Russia and China, because they see Russia and China supporting the incumbent regime. It's a very interesting change of events.
So how does this change the equation for Mr. Ahmadinejad as he resumes power or continues power as the president of Iran and Iran's foreign policy? Is this going to be a big enough distraction that they won't be able to deal with some of the foreign policy issues that are confronting them?
You know, that's a complicated question in the sense that Ahmadinejad now has, in some ways, a greater deal of dependency upon Khamenei, as we saw in the confirmation ceremony where he had to kiss the supreme leader's shoulder, a sign in Muslim societies of respect. And but at the same time, he did Ahmadinejad did hold his ground by confirming one of his relatives as essentially his chief of staff. So we can see degrees of independence, degrees of dependence, in part because the supreme leader, by coming out so early in favor of Ahmadinejad, not letting the electoral process play out, the supreme leader has himself committed the supreme leadership and the fundamentalists to Ahmadinejad. So there is this sort of interdependence there, and they seem to be attempting together to go after the reformists. It's unclear whether, A, they'll be able to quash the reform movement, but, B, it's also unclear whether, in any real sense, this is going to change the relationship with the United States, with the EU, because they may still focus on attempting to, shall we say, use the West as a foil for Iran.
800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join our discussion about Iran. 800-642-1234. We have an expert here who can answer your questions about that part of the world, which we're discussing this morning in this first hour of the program. 800-642-1234. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Well, President Obama has hinted at sanctions for Iran if they don't negotiate in good faith over their nuclear program. The Senate is considering sanctions, and this time they're looking at restricting imports to Iran of refined petroleum products as sanctions. So, a couple of questions here. One, is imposing sanctions the right thing to do if Iran doesn't negotiate in good faith over its nuclear program? And if we do impose them, would they work anyway?
Okay, a couple of wonderful questions. We should keep in mind that while Iran is an exporter of crude oil, it does not have sufficient refining facilities, and therefore it exports crude, but it also needs to import refined petroleum products, essentially gasoline for automobiles, for aircraft, etc. As a result, in a sense, Iran is dependent on the rest of the world, even in terms of petroleum products. So what the Senate is attempting to do is to say, look, if Iran does not cooperate, let's clamp down on that. Now, what has happened with sanctions over the years, and we've had essentially 30 years of sanctions against Iran, starting with the U.S. embassy hostages. What has happened is that ultimately these sanctions have affected the Iranian people more than they've affected the regime. Essentially, 30 years of sanctions has slowed down Iran's progress towards nuclear power. It has restricted its expansion of fundamentalism. It has, to some extent, played a role in confining Iran's political power to the Middle East. But it has not prevented the regime from moving forward. I think essentially, like politicians everywhere, if I may say so, Iran's politicians are always able to move funds for their pet projects. And so whether the new regime of sanctions will in fact deter Iran or whether it will actually end up hurting the Iranian people more is the question.
Well, and then that, I guess, brings up the whole issue of would sanctions help Mr. Ahmadinejad, for example, in turning the people's protests back toward death to America rather than being focused on getting rid of him?
He's certainly going to try to do so, John. He's certainly going to try to do so. I think at this point, the Iranian people are sort of divided on the sanctions issue. They understand that the sanctions have worked against the regime. They understand the sanctions also have hurt them. So certainly a new set of sanctions, let's say petroleum restrictions, will affect the Iranian people on a very daily basis because, you know, of them driving to work, you know, taking public transportation, all that will be affected. At the same time, they will see Ahmadinejad jetting around Iran in his helicopters and private jets to meet and greet. So it has that sort of dual effect. You know, one thing that the U.S. has never really considered for Iran that we have done successfully elsewhere is to target the individuals that maybe target sanctions against the individuals who are the troublemakers. You may recall that is how, right after 9/11, the U.S. went after al-Qaeda. We went after the bank accounts of the leaders, of the organizations, etc. And perhaps we should be thinking of sanctions directly against the hardliners in Iran rather than against Iran itself. And that's just a suggestion.
Let's talk a little bit. Well, actually, I tell you what, let's take a call from Dave in Menominee because I think he's going to ask a question that I was going to ask anyway. Dave, no. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you. You know, if Iran acquired the ability to deliver nuclear, some kind of nuclear warhead, how would that affect the way that Israel acts? You know, when Lebanon, you know, a few things happened, they grabbed some prisoners and Lebanon got themselves pounded and overreacted by Israel. Now, if Iran were able to counter Israel because of such, you know, actions that they do, acting like the victim and then overreacting as a response, would Iran be able to deter Israel from doing something like that by simply having some type of nuclear weapon?
You've really touched a very interesting point, Dave. And in fact, from what we are hearing recently, it would seem that Iran may already have nuclear weapons capability. They may be about a year or so from actually being able to assemble a weapon. What they seem to have been doing in the last couple of years, as you pointed out, is working on the delivery system, namely their missiles program. The danger posed by that is yes, Israel feels threatened, and with good reason, because if you look at the history of the Iranian nuclear program, you'll notice there was a period there for 8 years when Khatami was president, so the president just before Ahmadinejad. Khatami went around the world talking about dialogue and peace and all the rest. And while the West certainly was concerned about Iran's nuclear program, we were not afraid of Iran launching a preemptive attack. On the other hand, Ahmadinejad has sort of gone out of his way to be offensive towards other people. And so that's partly why there is this fear. Now, and I think the great danger, of course, is that Israel may launch a preemptive strike to prevent Iran from gaining a full nuclear weapons capability. If Iran were to gain it, would it serve as a deterrent? It may, but I think the problem is that Iran's nuclear capability is more an intimidation of the other Middle Eastern nations. Namely, what you see is that the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, even Egypt, react, very nervously to the thought of Iran having nuclear weapons. So in this case, it's not just Iran versus Israel or Israel versus Iran. It's almost like the entirety of the Middle East doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons capability.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our discussions with Professor Choksi and with you. Lines will be opening up shortly, 800-642-1234. The email is always open at talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today. After 2 on Talk of the Nation, writer Robert Feldman shed some light on lying, and Garrison Keillor has a tale about the state fair. Coming up after 2 on Talk of the Nation here on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is Jamshid Choksi, professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University. He joins us by phone, and so does Saeed in Green Bay. Let's go to him next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. What I wanted to discuss was the response of the Obama administration to developments in Iran right now, and how I believe that they are missing a historic opportunity to both advance the American national interest while they support the cause of freedom and democracy in Iran. They're missing this opportunity because I believe that they mistakenly believe that accommodating the power structure in Iran is the path to advancing American national interest. And nothing could be further from the truth. Two developments concern me very much. One is the attack on Camp Ashraf in Iraq a couple of weeks ago. Second is there's a journalist, an Iranian journalist, who has defied Iranian law. There's a law in Iran for journalists that cannot interview American government officials. In defiance of that law, a young Iranian journalist by the name of Masih Alinejad has come to the United States to interview Obama, and Obama is refusing to grant her an interview. Both of these, if you pay attention, are reveal a very different story about what the American intentions are than what Obama is publicly stating in terms of his reach to the Iranian people. He sent the Iranian people a message for Nowruz greetings, and now here, the daughter of Iran is here. Significant changes have happened in Iran in the last month and a half. The regime has lost all claims to legitimacy. The opposition is strong, sophisticated, dedicated, and this is born out of a 30-year experience of living under tyranny. What's going on in Iran today is nothing less than the classic confrontation of tyranny and liberty. And the Americans 50 years ago stood against the Iranian people when they stood against Mohammad Mossadegh, and they accommodated the then power structure.
Saeed, I think we lost your cell there, but let's give the professor a chance to respond. A lot to chew on there.
Yeah, a lot to chew on. John, actually, before I answer that, may I just tell your listeners that if they hear loud bangs and claps in the background, it's because we have a tremendous thunderstorm going on here in Indianapolis.
Okay.
So, but to back to the question, I think what we are seeing here is a young American administration grappling with how to deal with Iran, what you're seeing is conflicting voices and conflicting opinions within the Obama administration as to how to proceed forward, and that certainly is taking its toll in the sense of us not sending a clear message. Supporting the individuals in Iran who are seeking freedom has often been portrayed by the Iranian regime as putting those individuals together with the West. I think no one in Iran really believes that anymore. It's hard to make the case that Rafsanjani, even the Grand Ayatollah Montazeri, who's been under house arrest for years and yet has always spoken out against the regime, it's hard to believe those individuals have anything to do, with working with the West. So I think the Obama administration should proceed with supporting publicly, and far more than they have done, the protesters, pointing out that the protesters do have rights, do have liberties, should have freedom. And certainly what happened, the specific points, what happened in Iraq shows, in a sense, the limits of U.S. power. The emerging Iraqi government working with the Iranian government to crack down on a group that is regarded by Iran as a terrorist group. In fact, the MKO is regarded by the United States also as a terrorist group, but we sort of tacitly gave them protection in northern Iraq. We do need, the United States does need to clarify its message before it moves forward, let's say, with sanctions.
We have an email from Dan in Elkhorn, and I'm not quite sure I understand all of this, but I'll toss this out there. Maybe you can make some sense of it. Dan says, can you please address the statements made by the last president, George Bush, about 6 months before he left office, saying something like, we are actively seeking to destabilize the Iranian government using covert CIA operatives?
That all goes back to a series of news reports that deal with potential U.S. funding for tribal insurrections and various dissident movements both inside and outside Iran targeting Iran. In reality, most of those have never had any real impact on Iran. The United States just does not have the ability to destabilize Iran. What we are seeing occurring in Iran is essentially a buildup of 30 years of repression coming out now. And it's reached a point in Iran where it's nothing to do with the outside in terms of the internal protest. What the outside is involved in or should be involved in is helping support these protesters by championing their rights.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Richard in Fort Atkinson. Richard, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, with respect to the last call, the Congress last fall voted $400 million for covert operations in Iran, and you can hardly expect any Iranian political leader, liberal or otherwise, to not take that seriously. But I think that what's going on is an example of extreme paranoia. All the presidential candidates were vetted by the religious authorities. They all have essentially the same foreign policy. I think some are more modern than others. But you can understand the Iranian point of view if you look at a map. Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Turkmenistan, and you've got Iran surrounded. And clearly what the United States is trying to do is a military encirclement of Iran. And I believe that that a war from Israel or from the United States would be an absolute catastrophe. Yet even yesterday, Sunday in the New York Times, you have articles waiving the possibility of preventive attacks from the Israelis. I consider this highly irresponsible on the part of the West.
So just to make sure we're clear on this, Richard, when you talk about paranoia, whose paranoia are we talking about?
The Iranian regime. And I think that paranoia is induced by the policies of the West, in particular the United States.
Professor?
I think we should, when we look at the issue of paranoia, I think at this point we need to separate out the paranoia between, those who are holding on to power in Iran, who certainly have a degree of paranoia against the West, but who also use the West as a foil to maintain their own power. So we should put them in one group. We should put the Iranian people, and we should also put many of the prominent political opposition leaders at this point in the group with the people and say they understand the realism of politics with the West. They know that the United States is not in any position to actually mount any kind of ground or air offensive in Iran, and that even Israel, while Israel may be able to launch a strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, is even Israel does not really have the capacity to engage in any kind of long drawn out war with Iran. I think Iranians fundamentally know this. Everything I've heard of, every Iranian I've spoken to understands this. The People like Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, on the other hand, are able to, shall we say, use this to rally their own supporters with this constant claim that the West is coming to take over Iran. And certainly they can draw upon historical events to substantiate their claim. However, I think we need to separate, once again, history from modern politics.
Let's go next to Milton in Madison.
Hi. Three facts. The first is that there has been an awful lot of meddling. It's actually been more than $400 million, and I assure you they're quite effective at it. We can look back all the way to 1954, the year I was born, for Operation Ajax. Fact number two, Mr. Ahmadinejad, as a president, does not have control of the military. He cannot launch any kind of attacks on anybody. The Iranian government doesn't work that way. Third point, why are we always talking about, oh, the secret Iranian nuclear program and their nuclear intentions and this and that, when not all that long ago, didn't the entire quarrelsome family of intelligence agencies in this country, both military and civilian, report to President Bush that they did not have a nuclear program? And I have heard no reports from any military or civilian intelligence agencies since then claiming that they do. So why do we fly in the face of our entire intelligence apparatus?
Could you repeat the second point, please?
Okay, the second was Mr. Ahmadinejad.
Not having control, am I correct? Yes.
Yes,
he doesn't have control of the military,
and he cannot launch attacks.
Thank you. Yeah, the very interesting thing about the Iranian power struggle is that technically the military does report to the president, whoever that individual may be. However, as you point out quite correctly, sitting above the president, if you wish, is the supreme leader. So, the power structure is convoluted. It is not like Ahmadinejad can, launch any attack, whether it is, conventional or nuclear, without consulting with the various other branches of the government. Yes. If you asked me, what my professional opinion was, I do not believe that even if Iran had nuclear weapons, that they would launch them against anyone else. I think it is more defensive posture. That's one issue. The question of Iran actually working towards a nuclear program, that is a much more vexed one, because we have had, the various intelligence estimates that say Iran stopped the program in 2003. We've had conflicting reports both internally and externally, and even debate within the IAEA in terms of what Iran is or isn't doing. I think part of the problem with the whole Iranian nuclear program is that Iran reached a series of agreements and protocols with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and since then it's been sort of a cat-and-mouse game. The easiest way to clarify this, of course, is for Iran to abide by the protocols and agreements it reached with the United Nations and let the process resolve itself.
Thanks for the call, Milton. Let's go next to Betty in Waukesha.
Yes, I wonder why we cannot or do not broaden scope of our strategy and point out, I wonder, if the protesters and the regime in Iran understand that any war and this sparring and threatening in the face of global warming, Obama's strategy of cooperation, we are going to lose years. We are going to lose time that we need to find ways to cooperate and work together for the safety of us all. I don't see why we can't broaden the scope of our strategy, and I think once people are presented with that, perhaps they know it, and that's part of the reason why we have the protesters. It seems an absurdity on our part.
In fairness to Professor, in fairness to President Obama, I think it should be said that he has offered engagement and dialogue, such dialogue would have been possible on the part of the Iranian regime if they had gone through a fair and free electoral process. The problem is right now, having, shall we say, circumvented the election process, Ahmadinejad is, shall we say, in a corner where dialogue with the West has become more difficult for him. It is easier for him to play to his core constituency by denouncing the West. And so, unfortunately, the U.S. offer to actually, of an unclenched hand has not been met, with an extended hand by Iran.
What is the end game? What's the overall goal for the Iranian hardliners? Is it rational?
Two interesting questions. Is it rational? One may say that from their point of view, it is rational. In other words, they end up holding on to power. They retain essentially a religious state, which they believe in. And they are able to, play Iran off against the West. In terms of whether it could be successful or whether it is even beneficial for Iran, that one can argue is not the case, because certainly Iran and Iran's people would benefit from contact, interaction, not just with the West, but with the entire world. In other words, if Iran were to become a stable state working with and in cooperation with the rest of the world, Iran itself would develop economically and benefit a great deal. So shall we say that the end game the hardliners see may not in fact be the best for the Iranian people?
So they get to maintain their religious state. I don't know that a whole lot of people elsewhere in the world really care what religion the Iranians practice.
Right.
It doesn't matter to me. I'm being facetious a little bit here, but I mean, really, for everybody else, that I don't know how important a question that is. So what do they get out of, is this about their own personal financial gain? I guess maybe I'm trying to understand this from a Western perspective. And perhaps that's my problem. I'm not getting what it is that they get out of this, because I don't think anybody's asking them to give up their religion. We just want to get along.
Oh, of course. And even I think the way to approach this is to remove ourselves from the picture and look at Iran's own internal affairs. What's happening here is, and what we're seeing coming out in these protests, is a debate in Iran as to not their maintaining their religion, but what role religion should play in the daily life and the politics of a nation. That's the struggle and the debate going on in Iran between those who feel that religion has to direct all aspects of life, including politics, and those who feel that religion is just one aspect of life. So that's essentially the battle going on in Iran, not just between, shall we say, the ordinary people and the clergy, but within the Iranian clergy itself. And one of the reasons we're seeing these splits in the clergy is that a large number of Iranian clergy traditionally have believed that religion should inform politics, that clergymen should advise the government, but that clergymen should not run the government. And that point of view was overridden in the wake of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, where Khomeini created the position of supreme leader, created essentially a religious state. Even at that time, there were a considerable body of mullahs and ayatollahs in Iran who did not agree with that. And those individuals were sidelined, were placed under house arrest, were exiled, essentially forced out of politics. And now we are seeing those voices returning, shall we say the pragmatic voices, saying, religion is important, But religion should not be trying to run a modern nation state. So that's the internal Iranian struggle of which we're seeing the ramifications, both in terms of the protests, but also in terms of the West being denounced, because that's one way in which the religious hardliners can claim that they have to maintain a religious state.
Well, you know, that's really fascinating, because I had a conversation a week or so ago with a member of the Christian clergy who was kind of complaining that there were a lot of people in the Christian church in the United States who were imposing their worldview on Christianity. And now it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is that the same thing, in a way, is happening in Iran, or has happened in Iran, where you've got a group of people who have taken their worldview and imposed it on Islam instead of Islam informing their worldview.
That's a good way to put it, John, because that's exactly what happened in the build-up to the 1979 revolution. And shortly after that, a lot of Iranians, even those who participated in favor of Khomeini and the clerics during the 79 revolution, did not expect to see this sort of theocracy emerge in Iran. And many of them have left the government, have been exiled, etc. And so what you can see, even with someone like Rafsanjani, is, you know, here's someone who was part of the revolution, who's been a two-term president of Iran, who is the head of the Assembly of Experts, such a person, you know, public, and someone who's become tremendously wealthy after the revolution. You're seeing someone like that come out and say, you know, look, we have gone too far. So that's the internal struggle. The problem is that the hardliners who want to maintain that state keep returning to, shall we say, the old themes of it's the bad West who's after us. And certainly, yes, as your callers have pointed out, as I have mentioned, as you've mentioned, the United States has been involved in the past, and the United States certainly does have strategic interests in that region. However, I think there is really no way we can determine the outcome of events in Iran, and I don't think we're really trying to. We are, shall we say, waiting to see what happens, perhaps hoping that shall we say, a working, secular state will emerge in Iran.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we have full phone lines, and so we'll be taking calls for the rest of the hour. Hang in there. We'll be right back, and we'll get to your calls as soon as we can. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9:45, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In my next hour, my guest and I will be examining a newly developing economic model that promotes a healthy economy while respecting the natural environment and the well-being of the human race. I'll be talking with Jeffrey Garver, environmental consultant and lecturer in law from Montreal. He's co-author of the book Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. That's after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, for the rest of this hour, we're talking about Iran. And we have with us Jamshid Chokshi, professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University, and he's braving a thunderstorm in Indianapolis to be with us today. So we better pay attention. Professor, before we go back to the phones, there was one more question I wanted to be sure we got to in this hour, and that is, there was a Time magazine story recently, perhaps you saw this, which spoke about Iran's commercial and mercantile interests and how crucial they've been to the country's political history. How influential is the bazaar, and where do the business interests stand in terms of the reform movement in Iran today?
The business interests are very important. However, I think we, at this point, need to move beyond seeing the business interests as being the bazaar. The traditional bazaar was very important for the constitutional revolution in Iran in 1905-1906, which is when the first parliament in Iran, etc., was set up. It was also important when Mossadegh was overthrown with the U.S. and British assistance. So the bazaar was important in bringing back the Shah. The bazaaris played a part in the 1979 revolution. But I think at that point, Iran was sort of moving more into, shall we say, modern commercial networks. And so we should say the business community played an important role. And the business community continues to play an important role. Iran is intrinsically linked with the EU. The EU is Iran's largest trading partner. And so, you know, this ruckus we had after the election, where the Iranian government arrested Iranians who were working in the British embassy, certainly hurt Iran's trade with the West, with the EU. Iran has a tremendous trading networks with the Gulf states. And Iran's nuclear development makes those states and those business communities quite uneasy. In other words, a large part of Iran likes dealing with the world, likes having, you know, all the commercial networks we do. It sort of reminds me of one incident some years ago in Iran. I was in southwestern Iran in the city of Ahwaz, and I was checking into a hotel there. And as I was checking in, there was actually a condo sales event going on. And it was pretty much like an American condo sales. There were condo developments in the Gulf states, and these companies had come and were hosting a luncheon with high-pressure sales tactics, trying to convince Iranians to buy condominiums in the Gulf, to come vacation there so they could toss off the robes and enjoy the good life, shall we say. And as soon as they realized that this American was there, an American professor, they grabbed me, pulled me in, and said, hey, tell us if we are doing the sales pitch right. So that should give you one, you know, give you some flavor of, you know, how the Iranian business community works. It is open to the West. It wants the contact. In fact, it laments the economic sanctions because it sees those sanctions as a result of the hardline attitude taken by Iran's administration.
Let's take Carl in Madison next. Carl, good morning.
Good morning,
Carl.
Professor Chuksi and John, in the middle-late 1950s, the National Geographic ran a feature article about the Iranian Kurds. Now, in the early 1960s, as an undergraduate, I became chums with the son of the chieftain featured in that article.
Uh-huh.
And we weren't close friends, but we were far, far, far more than just casual acquaintances. And he spent a lot of time explaining to me the Kurdish separatist movement that was happening there. And this was just after they had settled from being nomads to a settled tribal group. This is from 50 years ago, so I don't want to get into specifics, and not only that, some of the things he told me might have been pretty sensitive. But what my questions are is, what is the current relationship between the central government and the Iranian Kurds? What has that situation been resolved? And what is the relationship between the Iranian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds?
Excellent questions, and if I may sort of even put those in a broader context. What we have seen happening through much of the 20th century, both with active involvement of the Iranian state and by more passive means such as economic inducements, etc., there's been an attempt to, shall we say, detribalize these groups, to make them, shall we say, settled peoples, to integrate them in the larger economic and social framework of Iran. It has been quite successful. That doesn't mean that, you know, we have moved people out of their traditional areas. So you still do have a part of northwestern Iran that is pretty much, shall we say, a Kurdistan, a very beautiful area, having traveled through it. So you can certainly still see linguistic and cultural differences. But those differences at this point are quite often, shall we say, very much similar to the differences we see regionally across the United States. So in that sense, you don't have, shall we say, you know, the traditional idea of a tribe still, shall we say, entrenched in large areas of Iran. You still do have tribal groups, you still have nomadic groups, but they are no longer, shall we say, major players. But the other question, namely the Kurds of Iran with the Kurds of Iraq and the Kurds even of Turkey, the problem there is that that does raise, shall we say, aspirations to being a separate nation. But again, you can see the problem there is it crosses three nation states. And neither one of those nation states wants to give up part of its territory. And so you will end up seeing essentially Iran, Iraq, and Turkey work together to prevent any separatist movements. Just as, shall we say, in the southeast of Iran, you have the Baluch, and the Baluch tribes cross Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And once again, you see those three nations working together to prevent any, shall we say, separatist nation of Baluchistan emerging.
Thanks for the call, Carl. Appreciate it. Let's go next to Derek in Round Lake, Illinois. Derek, good morning.
Yes, hi, good morning. Good show. There are 3 points I would like to make as far as the Iranian situation is concerned. A few years back, I was in Seoul, Korea, attending a journalism conference, and I've run into quite many, about 17 or 18 different bloggers, journalists, from Iran inside and also the expatriates and exiles. And they came from different political and socioeconomic strata, you know, a lot of different divisions, what have you. But it was very interesting that they're quite unanimous about having U.S. be totally stay out of the process of modernization, liberalization of the Iranian politics. They basically said if the U.S. administration in any shape or form would get involved in the process of shaping political opinion or political choice within Iran, this would basically be a death to their movement. Second point I'd like to make is that the current brouhaha about Iranians developing nuclear capacity, this actually originally started in the 1970s when the American administration has introduced Westinghouse projects into Iran itself to build up their nuclear capacity. So there was already project was undergoing before even this whole thing came about with the recent developments. And the third point I'd like to make, which is quite interesting, Professor just mentioned earlier about sanctions. Back in 1981, when the Polish communist government was actually under sanctions from the Reagan administration, the spokesman for the Polish government during the very interesting press conference said that, and he was actually vilified by that in the Western press, he specifically said that no matter what sanctions would be imposed, the government will always feed itself, and the people will be the ones to basically take the brunt of the whole problem. So I think these are the three elements which I think are quite important in the current debate about Iranian politics.
Professor?
Yeah. Once again, you have fascinating callers. I'm delighted to be on the show. In terms of staying out of Iran, I don't think there is any capability of the U.S. being, shall we say, on the ground or actively involved in a sense of trying to of being able to really reshape Iran's politics. I think that the important difference that has occurred here recently is that it is no longer plausible for the claim that it is the U.S. or Britain or Israel or any other nation, the internal Iranian claim that the outside is shaping events in Iran is no longer plausible. What we are seeing here is cutting across social, economic, religious ranks in Iran, so what we are seeing is the emergence of what had previously been, shall we say, underground popular discontent. And I think that's going to play out. What needs to happen eventually is that as that plays out, those individuals are going to expect contact with the West, and such contact does need to be provided, which, of course, comes to the third point, namely sanctions, which I think we began this program with, namely that sanctions do tend to hurt the people and that the politicians always are able to squirrel away resources they need for their pet projects. Now, one of those pet projects, as we have talked about on the show, is this whole issue of nuclear energy and nuclear weaponization. And we've seen the Obama administration say very clearly, we've seen Senator Kerry come out and talk about how Iran is free to pursue nuclear energy, but not to proceed to nuclear weaponization. And so we have that, shall we say, the divide. The U.S. certainly was involved under the Shah in setting up Iran's nuclear energy program. But it was for nuclear energy to replace petroleum when Iran's petroleum resources ran out. The program was interrupted, of course, by the revolution, then restarted after the revolution when Rafsanjani became president. The difference between the, shall we say, the pre-revolution and post-revolution programs is that the post-revolution program has always had, shall we say, this cloud of nuclear weapons surrounding it. And that is what has created a lot of the tensions with the world.
Well, Professor, we're just about out of time, so I don't want to introduce any new topics. But in reference to our callers, yes, we have wonderful callers, and it makes my job just a whole lot
easier.
I'm
quite sure.
Thanks so much for joining us today. This is always a fascinating topic. I hope we can have you back again and talk about it further.
It would be my great pleasure. Thank you.
Jamshed Choksi is Professor of Central Eurasian Studies, History, Ancient Studies, and India Studies, and Adjunct Professor of Religious Studies at Indiana University. He joined us by phone. He, of course, a specialist in Iranian history who's traveled throughout Iran. It was a pleasure to have him with us today. If you missed part of the program, want to go back and hear the beginning of it again, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and go to Kathleen Dunn's page, and you should be able to listen to it sometime later today, I would think. Carmen Jackson produced this hour of programming. Bill Martins and Beto McQuaid handled on-air production. Stay tuned. We'll be talking about possible changes that need to be made in our entire Earth's commercial system if we're going to survive. So says the author of the book under discussion after the news. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.